From beach towels to tea towels, and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT Shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I am Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Issa Bloomy joins me today, as he does each and every Monday. Issa is an associate professor in the Department of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Stockholm University. He's a historian, and he is the author of multiple books, including most recently, Destroying Yemen, What Chaos in Arabia Tells Us About the World. Issa, how are you, my friend?
Good evening, Jesse. Good evening to your audience. Hope you're well.
Yes, I am. It's rainy and cold here, but that's to be expected this time of year. Though I wish it were still summer, or at least somewhat warmer. But so it goes. Probably a bit like where you are in Sweden right now, I imagine.
We had a beautiful day actually today. No one's lighting cigarettes out of fear of blowing up from all the methane gas in our atmosphere. But otherwise, it was a beautiful day. Yeah.
Is that really a fear? That's
no. It's a joke. But we did get my part of Sweden did have a cloud of methane at some point cross over the weekend and it went elsewhere in Scandinavia, but probably was not very healthy for the wildlife and for the human inhabitants of Scandinavia. Welcome to NATO, basically.
Exactly. So let's start with Yemen, because yesterday the truce that was brokered under the auspices of the UN on April 2nd came to an end. There was no renegotiation to extend this truce. So what that means, broadly speaking, is that there's no more ceasefire, although during the 6 months of truce, when there was supposed to be a ceasefire, Saudi, the UAE, and its partners in crime violated the truce thousands upon thousands of times in many different ways. So it's no wonder to me that Ansar Allah has no interest in renewing this truce, which really served as mostly a token gesture, although if you look at a piece published yesterday in Saba News, which is a Yemeni news agency, it is written that, quote, the truce in Yemen, which entered into force on the 2nd of last April under the auspices of the United Nations, represented the first breakthrough at the level of calming the war since its outbreak in 2015 and the aggression against the Yemeni people, which can be said that it has contributed through its provisions to alleviating the fighting, unquote. So there is a small sense that these 6 months did provide some alleviating, as Saba points out, but really nothing to write home about, it seems. What is your take on where things stand now?
Right. So where they stand now is, I'm afraid it was a strategic mistake. The momentum was certainly on the side of the resistance to the empire leading up to April. There were, as we've talked several times, significant successes on the battlefront, especially going towards the key oil, natural gas resources that probably ignited and started the wheels turning towards addressing what could have been a catastrophe for the few oil companies that were profiting from exporting daily natural gas and oil from Yemen's Marib and Sabwa fields. And again, we've discussed this before, and we've also discussed the quite stunning attacks, successful attacks using missiles and drones by the resistance in North Yemen, actually in UAE and Saudi territories, to make it quite clear that if this war would continue and not be resolved, that their infrastructure would be vulnerable to destruction. And so the initiating parties were clearly those who were putting pressure on the United States and their allies. They saw their assets vulnerable to being either destroyed, as Ansar Allah today and yesterday, in the last couple of days, have warned that if anyone thinks they are going to continue to benefit from exploiting Yemeni's resources without proper compensation. As per the agreements, by the way, in April, that's the money mm-hmm. that was being made from selling oil and gas that was ending up in Saudi bank accounts were supposed to pay for the salaries of government employees, and that was not. The money was simply redirected to pay for many of Saudi's bills. But mm-hmm. so that's one thing. The fact that they stopped the barrage of weapons coming from North Yemen into Saudi Arabia, into the UAE, and more importantly, the destruction of manpower capacities on the ground, allowed for especially Saudi Arabia to gain some oxygen in their lungs to basically protect themselves from the very bad image that when they had their F1 race, for instance, in Jeddah, you had plumes of smoke coming from a refinery that was hit by Ansar Allah missiles. Mm-hmm. These were registering on international financial markets, certainly insurers, the insurance industry. And it was a very hard sell then for Saudi Arabia actually to be a place, a destination point for investors' monies, tourists, and tourism, which is one of the main industries that they want to promote and pursue moving forward, to bring some value to the infrastructure and the real estate they've been developing and hope to develop. So that ceasefire has been, for the most part, a main beneficiary has been Saudi Arabia and UAE. In the meantime, with the Biden administration making it suspiciously clear from day one, and I've again alerted an audience in another program already in February, that they're going to use the pretext of threatening, and indeed they successfully did through the United Nations, to call Ansar Allah a terrorist organization, which China mm-hmm. and Russia signed off on, and they continue to refer to Ansar Allah as a terrorist organization, mm-hmm. that this would be a pretext then to allow the United States to enter into the war directly, that they're fighting terrorism, they're fighting a belligerent who's Iranian-supported, they're fighting a belligerent who will refuse a ceasefire. Now that the ceasefire has ended, and through the UN, the fingers are all being pointed at Ansar Allah for being recalcitrant, not being a good negotiating partner. Look at how the Saudis and the UAE were so good and actually allowed for ceasefire to start in the first place. The moment outbreak of violence takes place, and if Ansar Allah fulfills its promise of actually hitting those companies and those resources that are extracting wealth from Yemen, they're going to be blamed for it. And the American troops, the French troops who are already on the ground, who have been filtering in for the last 6 months into southern Yemen, are going to be used to directly try to end the war on America's terms, on mm-hmm. empire's terms. And this is my big concern. And I'm pretty sure that the guys up in Ansar Allah's headquarters, they're aware of this. I know that they have good intelligence about the kind of manpower capacities that are available. in southern Yemen and on the borders with Yemen in Saudi Arabia. But with Israel now very overtly partner with Saudi Arabia and the UAE, with the Americans and French with actual troops on the ground, and the fact that people have been given this 6 months of a reprieve of daily bombardments. There have been bombs. There have been strategic attacks. We're using drones, trying to assassinate certain actors. They certainly have denied northern Yemenis fuel. There have been only a few flights where people who had money could actually get out of Yemen, North Yemen, via Cairo, those flights from Cairo. But the vast majority of people now have... are now faced with a potential much more violent campaign with actual American planes, actual American soldiers doing the killing. Now, mercenaries were doing it before. Now it's going to be an official, my concern is it will be an official policy where American troops will be justified to intervene because the UN tried to intervene. And the Saudis and the in UAE, in good faith, offered to renew it once again, and those damn Ansarullah, those damn terrorists who are supported by Iran, have refused. And now look at them. They're not only hitting oil and gas, which could be used to feed the people of North Yemen, right? But this is the narrative that's coming out of internationally recognized think tanks filled with would-be scholars from Yemen who have no recourse and who have no morals and have spent their life, their adult life in Washington, D.C., getting scholarships to go to Georgetown and then, to serve that particular role, being to give legitimacy to policies that empire are going to promote and push on Yemen. And yes, we've seen that with Iran. We've seen that with the case of another war zones. You have the purposeful placement of so-called expertise with Yemenis or natives of the specific countries who promote the policies of empire. And you're seeing them really stepping up their rhetoric now. And the blame is already starting on pointing fingers at Ansarullah. And I just quickly before we end, just in case we don't talk about this, interesting enough, OMV, the Austrian company that was notorious for being involved in exporting and therefore stealing Yemeni resources, in this interim period of a ceasefire, sold their assets to French Total, which was already a minor player in some of these fields and now has suddenly become a major player. So OMV, for whatever reason, calculated that it would be better to get out of the business of stealing Yemeni oil while they could. And it's very interesting that French troops came more or less at the same time when Total signed on the dotted line and bought OMV's assets, which extends from drilling to pipelines to the facilities at the port, which then gets delivered to Chinese or Greek ships and going off the global market. So there's a lot of calculations have been made. Some people have certainly gotten out of Dodge, so to speak. They've profited for a long time. They've gotten out. The Biden people who started this war during the Obama administration, who are back in power, have set up for direct intervention. This is my main concern now, that once a full-out war starts again, it's not going to just be incompetent Saudi mercenaries from Sudan and a couple of well-paid Australians and Americans who are hiding behind ski masks. It's going to be American troops with an American flag enforcing something from the United Nations, enforcing, in support of international outcry for Ansarullah's failure to continue to promote a ceasefire. And this is, I think, the situation that we're at. And in the meantime, Yemenis are suffering. Their people are hungry. They're dying of disease. Now, there is no fuel for them. And they have to basically accept whatever comes through the UN and the embargo mechanisms that are enforced by the UN and Russia and China and France and Japan and many other countries who are supposedly neutral in this campaign. There are no neutral actors here. And certainly the one of the main conspicuous actors who are not involved is in fact Iran, despite the fact Iran is constantly mm-hmm. evoked in this. Iran has no contribution to this conflict at all, other than showing solidarity from very, very far away. So it's yes. not a good situation for the people of Yemen.
Yes, the absence of Iran, even to the point of saying anything about what is currently happening, has been, as you said, conspicuous to say the least, and I would add shameful. I understand very much that Iran is dealing with a lot internally right now, but as you and I talked about a few weeks ago, it also seems to be very concerned with rebranding itself on the international stage, especially as pertains the so-called emerging multipolar New World Order. So that might have something to do with it distancing itself from what's going on in Yemen, which, again, is both conspicuous and shameful.
Yeah. Let's just be clear that with the exception of perhaps a few individuals, Yemen never received weapons from Iran. Iran was mm-hmm. only providing vocal support and would occasionally issue statements that would include Yemen in a larger statement about the crimes committed by empire, things like that. And as you rightly say, they have certainly modified their interactions with the larger world, and Yemen has fallen off their radar screen in large part because they wanted to cooperate in the Shanghai context, which they again mm-hmm. they invited Bahrain. they gave the seal of approval to bring in Saudi Arabia and the UAE into this enterprise. So that tells you what that political elite, that political class who have taken power recently in Iran, are really thinking and what their strategy is. Now, that doesn't necessarily bode well for a significant part of the rest of Iranian society, but it's very suspicious that it also, at the same time, all this stuff that's happening now with on the streets where significant portions of Iranians' military and police capacities have been undermined. There are a lot of solidarity now with people on the streets. And, you know, this is kind of like a moment in 2011 in Syria where my concerns with Iran, and certainly nothing that Iran is doing will be focused on issues like Palestine or Yemen moving forward. So mm-hmm. Yemenis have always been on their own. There has been some solidarity echoed through some of the internet, but they are now certainly on their own, and I'm afraid they're going to see a much more violent next couple of months, if indeed this breaks out again, this war, which I have to be realistic, and I think it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why it wouldn't happen, right? I mean, they've been fighting this damn thing for 7 years, trying to accomplish something, and now I think they got the right people and the right narrative to make this completely feasible. And whether or not they'll succeed is really up to Yemenis and how much they're going to resist this. But it's going to be a bloodbath, I'm afraid. Again.
Yes. Yes. Well, two things I want to bring up and get your response to. Speaking of Total, they recently firmed up an agreement involving France and Qatar for Qatar to provide much needed energy to France. Total is the main, if not the only, player on the French side in that deal. So that's happening. And we know that Qatar is a main actor on the ground in Yemen and has been for quite some time. And also with regard to Saudi and the UAE, they very much worked their way into this multipolar club, if I can call it that, with Russia and China. And as an example of this, in the most recent prisoner swap that Russia and Ukraine carried out, it was mediated by Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi and also substantial help was provided by Erdogan of Turkey. And in this prisoner swap, Russia handed over to Ukraine 95 fighters who were captured at Azovstal, which is the steel plant in Mariupol, where there was fierce fighting, and the fighters, many of them belonging to Azov, were holed up there. So 95 of the fighters captured there were returned to Ukraine, and a large number of them were members of Azov, the Nazis or neo-Nazis that Russia has been clamoring about since February 24th. And they are indeed that element, but Russia is just fine giving them back for whatever benefits it can secure in return. And it's willing to go to the extent of working with MBS to mediate this. And now these Azov fighters and their colleagues are waiting out, I suppose, some sort of post-release period in Turkey under Erdogan's protection. So what we have essentially is Saudi with Turkey and the UAE getting more and more comfortable in this multipolar club, as I put it. And if and when something reignites in Yemen, of course, Saudi and the UAE are going to curry favor with Russia and China. Not that it was different in the past, but I think they're going to curry much more favor this time around if and when something in Yemen reignites.
Well, for sure, MBS, you have to remember that MBS was just around this time. And I think, again, there are lots of beneath the surface, which we have no media, no reporting whatsoever what's going on inside Saudi Arabia itself. But the persistent rumblings and discontent around this character and the apparatus that he's created around him has led to even increasing attempts to shore up his protection, if you will, by being associated with international events. This was certainly a gift for local consumption. I don't think anyone in the larger world was, this was not marketed to the larger world. And look how MBS is a man of a diplomatic, you know, a genius now. That actually was very little reporting on this. It was for indigenous local consumption in these various countries, Turkey and Saudi Arabia, because he was de facto now, it's formally, he's been declared also the Minister of Defense in Saudi Arabia, which has a lot of consequences for contracting for some of these actors who are actually in the inner walls, if you will, of this apparatus of the Ministry of Defense in Saudi Arabia, which has, again, very nebulous interactions with the military industrial complex of the larger global economy. It was a gesture, a concession that allowed for MBS to position himself in the international context for an audience that was mostly local. Again, it was not celebrated. International media. I don't know how you got this story, but it's a forgotten gesture for sure. And again, Turkey, Erdogan is facing enormous problems with inflation that registers around 80%. in cities like Istanbul, it's over 100%. He and his party and his acolytes are very, very nervous. And so they're desperate to constantly play through media these kinds of gestures where you see him in a prominent role internationally, whether it be supporting Azerbaijan, whether it be showing up for Samarkand for the Shanghai Agreement, whether it's through this duplicitic role that Turkey plays. If we continue to think about this war, so-called war between Russia and the West, as one that really does constitute two rival parties, my suspicion is that it's in fact part of a narrative that is sold to us. But if you look on the ground, whether it be in things like Yemen or what's happening in selling weapons to Turkey or to other parties, there seems to be much more cooperation between Israel, the United States, Russia, through the United Nations or through intermediaries like Turkey or Saudi Arabia than rivalries. I think there's a lot more cooperation going on elsewhere in the world. And yes. Perhaps we can even think about this whole war over Ukraine in some kind of sick way, also an element of cooperation where the interested parties are securing their interests at the expense of civilians and these poor guys were put in the meat grinder of war as these weapons are these old, you know, Warsaw Pact era weapons are just being blown up by more sophisticated weapons, which could be used as marketing tools for countries that have some autonomy in their budgets, and they're looking now for opportunities to spend more money on one weapon systems versus another. There has been rumors that they have already come to an agreement in October 25 that there will be a ceasefire, that the borders that are more or less being drawn out with Russian troops evacuating certain areas will be the new de facto borders, something akin to what's happened in the Caucasus. And that will be a concession that will lead to, you know, abandoning Armenia entirely, and maybe even push for redrawing boundaries formally elsewhere in Balkans or in parts of Africa, especially the Horn of Africa. Probably Yemen will likely be something that we'll see. We'll see an annexation of the eastern Mahra province by Saudi Arabia, or there could be an overture for that. And maybe with Turkey getting some of northern Iraq and Syria to integrate those areas into and unify those areas. So that's my predictions for what I see. I'm much more cynical or say realistic. I don't believe this story anymore. There's just too many areas of cooperation elsewhere to tell me that these are actually belligerents who are going to basically fight to the end, and only one will succeed. I find that just no longer acceptable as a way of analyzing what's happening on the ground. I'm afraid I can't.
I don't find it narrative. I don't find it acceptable either, and I think that's based on realism and not cynicism. And there is so much cooperation going on despite the dominant narrative of West versus East. And I want to get into some of that when we come back after a quick pause. So everybody hang tight, and I'll be right back here with Issa Bloomy on TNT Radio after this.
TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
I mean, you have the government, you know, labeling parents who speak up at school boards, terrorists, domestic terrorists, of course. And you have everything from teachers don't have to report to parents once they're in the school. It seems like teachers and the teachers unions now believe that they own the rights to your kids when it comes to even if the kid wants a sex change or wants to use a different bathroom or wants to be called by a he or a she if they're the opposite, and they don't have to tell parents. And I mean, it goes down the line. And what concerns you the most as a parent? And in your view, what should parents be concerned about the most when they send their kids to school?
You know, I think the most concerning thing is just the lack of transparency. The thought that parents don't deserve to know what's going on in schools and in their kids' education is so ridiculous, considering we all pay taxes and we all elect school board members, yet somehow we're told that we don't have a right to know what's going on.
Steve Malzberg on TNT Radio.
What is dedication?
I am the father of a 9-year-old little girl and a 6-year-old little boy. And I find fatherhood both relentlessly challenging and relentlessly rewarding. My daughter is biological and my son is adopted. I love them both so much. From the morning when you wake up to putting them to bed at night, and every moment in between, it really is so special, and boy, is it exhausting. One thing that I fear about being a parent is the future for my children. I think a parent's job is to protect our children, but also prepare them for the world so they become good, kind human beings. But I'm also hopeful that the future holds a more inclusive and compassionate world for them.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
This is where you get your daily ration of high-velocity conversation. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Perspective here on TNT Radio, where we are live 24/7. I'm Jesse Zerwell, and I'm speaking with Issa Blumi, who is joining me from Sweden. So, Issa, there are many things afoot that reveal cooperation that does not jive with the narrative of West versus East, or the US / NATO versus Russia. And there is cooperation on Russia's part in terms of the COVID-19 pseudo pandemic and perpetuating that is both extremely telling and very, very disturbing. So to start with the COVID-19 pseudo pandemic, Riley Wagaman, independent journalist who is based in Russia, in Moscow, he put out a report today on his Substack, Russia Begins Vaccinating Mobilized Citizens, the subheader of which is evading mobilization and mandatory vaccination could lead to 10 years in prison. So essentially what is happening, and this has been published by multiple Russian media outlets, is that all of the 300,000 reservists who were called up must be injected with the COVID-19, Russia's version of the COVID-19 vaccine, in inverted commas. And if they refuse to, that by extension means they're attempting to evade military service and could face 10 years in prison. So as Riley writes, quote, in other words, Russia has just adopted one of the world's strictest coercive injection policies, unquote. So there's that. And he goes on to write after that, I should read, quote, Russians are being asked to risk their lives in an increasingly dubious war in Ukraine. And in return, they are being forcibly injected with an unproven and most likely expired genetic slurry, unquote. And the expired part has been proven. Russia has been, much like here in the US, using expired batches on its citizens. So there's that cooperation with the COVID pseudo pandemic, that global psyop / murder campaign / many other things that's been going on for the past 2.5 years. And we have Russia continuing to sell weaponry to Turkey, back in August, as Sputnik reported, Russia begins supplies of 2nd S-400 Regiment to Turkey, Defense Cooperation Agency, Russia's Defense Cooperation Agency being the source of the information provided for this story. And to add to that, on Friday, Sweden, where again you are, announced that it's resuming its sales of weapons to Turkey. So we have three connected big tells here, I would say, that, as I said and as you said, suggest major cooperation between supposedly warring entities. And this cooperation just can't be ignored. We can't look away from this and say, well, yes, but look, there's an existential crisis Russia is in the middle of right now, and we need to focus on that. That's not flying anymore. And more evidence comes out every day to put the lie to that narrative. So I want to get your take on what I just laid out.
Yeah, it's firstly with this, in the context of a national emergency, which requires 300,000 able-bodied men who otherwise could either be useful in larger society or potentially dangerous. Who knows what they're actually calculating and how, you know, the frustrations of young men in many parts of Russia, if unless they actually get disciplined in a way, put them into a military front lines of a sham war, and in the meantime, poison them. What's the underlying calculation behind all that? Yes, the emphasis will be on strategic necessity and all that kind of stuff, but the very fact that they're injecting them with these things that are clearly causing adverse effects is quite remarkable. And it's so heartbreaking to see, you know, what's the recourse for people. It's just so sad that hundreds of thousands of people's lives are affected by these machinations of political elites who clearly have much more in common than our differences. And there are, of course, no ideological principles. There are no fundamental values that are being upheld here. It's abusive. It's an abuse of state power. It will help directly impact the lives and probably kill lots of young men who otherwise had no stake in this and were most likely going to play an important role in the subsequent decade of real struggle over who's going to actually lay claim to the direction of our larger humanity. And mm-hmm. We can see that people in many parts of the world are being subjected to coercion to, you know, submit to this medical apartheid. And I'm pretty sure we're going to see similar kinds of demands being put on people elsewhere who have been hesitant to adhere to these policies. And it's not by mistake that, and I'm pretty sure that most of these men, 300,000 men, have been registered and been identified as having not been shot up before, right? So their numbers are going to be called by the recruiter, and they're going to have to show up and stick their arm out and avail themselves for a globalist poison. So that's
certainly one. I'm not so sure if they haven't been injected already, because in June of 2021, let me just refer back to Riley's piece here. He writes, quote, Russia's Ministry of Defense made COVID vaccination mandatory for all personnel, including conscripts, in June 2021, unquote. So some...
Would that include those who are now being called up?
I mean, well, reservists, conscripts. Reservists are being called up. So I don't know if they are included as personnel or not, but
so then these all would of be that to say there as opposed to
all of that to say there may be a chance that they're being forcibly injected again since the first time was mandated in inverted commas.
Well, again, so the point is that they're emphasizing that we're going to force these guys to take these shots, regardless if they've had it before or not. It should tell us something, right? That this is something that we actually get registered, and your colleague actually is able to identify this and present this to his readership. The second thing with Turkey is it's an ongoing story, the endless hypocrisy. And I would include Israel in this, by the way. Poor Syria, mm-hmm. which has gone through, bless the those guys and women who put up and with the fight and fought off the Takfiri maniacs that the Americans and Qataris and Saudis unleashed onto that country. And the conditions were rapidly changing, and with the sudden intervention by Russia in 2015, it stemmed some of the continued war, and it changed the dynamics a little bit. But Israel continued to bomb at will the Syrian and Iranian assets inside Syria, and that continues until today, right? We know that. Mm-hmm. So Russia has not intervened in that regard and has not protected Syrians from this belligerency. It has not protected Syria from the pillaging of its resources, much of it which then goes right through Turkey, and Erdogan's gangsters are direct beneficiaries of this. The very fact that Armenia, which in theory should have strong, good relations with Moscow, has been the target for annexation and continuous war and pressure from Azerbaijan and Turkey, undermines that any claim that Russia is playing an important barrier to this kind of bullying from the likes of Erdogan and his colleagues in Azerbaijan. And then, we continue to see military cooperation with a NATO country, which is a frontline NATO country, which has again been invested heavily in destroying Syria, destroying northern Iraq. Russia has now is sending over its advanced defense mechanisms, its S-400 missile systems. In the meantime, literally the same day that this news was circulated around Sputnik News, Turkish news and in some European media picked up that they just launched an important advanced ship to be sent to the Ukrainian Navy. In the meantime, also, Turkey continues to sell and provide the expertise on working with the Bayraktar drone, which has been very effective in wreaking havoc on Russian troops on the front lines. So here is Russia working directly with the main supplier of weapons to the so-called enemies in neighboring Ukraine, with which it's supposedly having a war with, a war to the end. So there, the contradictions and the hypocrisies, if you want to call it that, I think the game is up, the gig is up. There's just, we have to start talking about these things in different terms, because it's clearly that there is something bigger than the simple narrative that's being presented to us about the nature of the relationship Russia has with its neighbors, because it's directly cooperating and arming with, and that you don't just install an S-400 system without Russian soldiers on the ground telling them and explaining to them how you implement this, how you actually operate these things. So this is literally NATO officers working with Russian officers to install this weapon system. In the meantime, the Turks are developing and exporting advanced, very sophisticated unmanned drones to Ukraine, as well as Navy ships to Ukraine, which will be used against Russian soldiers. And then I've already itemized the whole story, the whole nonsense with Syria and poor Syria, which is kind of caught in the corner, and they have no recourse but to beg for some kind of negotiated conclusion to where they will likely lose 3/4 of their oil resources to a combination of American, Qatari, Turkish interests, and maybe there'll be a core unit where they can keep Damascus and a coastline which of course is full of natural gas, which is now all going to become very attractive now that prices are spiking. And lo and behold, Russian gas companies are also benefiting, by the way, oil companies, they're benefiting from the oil prices being where they are. Oil prices have been dipping because there is not that much demand. And so, you know, let's create a spike again. And lo and behold, we have this pipeline, which is not being used, supposedly. There's no delivery of gas being taking place. It gets blown up the same day that a Norwegian-Polish pipeline had been finally completed and they turned on the spigot. So I don't see any attempt at sabotaging that infrastructure. The gas still flows through Ukraine from Russia, even though they're griping about payments, back payments. But gas still flows to Ukraine. Gas is certainly flowing to China and to other markets. So Russian companies are making pretty hefty profits in the context of war. Everyone is happy, at least in the industry side. They're making huge amounts of money because there's a crisis out there. And I'm sure the Russian companies that make all those bullets and those bombs that are blowing up poor kids on the front lines, they have to be paid for, right? Those are weapons that bullets need to be bought. The shots need to be bought and paid for. So there's people making money on that side too. War is a racket. We've heard this before in the 1920s, right? By the famous whistleblower in the United States, he said, look, they're going to wage war forever because it's so much money. Even Eisenhower warned Americans about the military-industrial complex. Well, the same applies to the oil industry and in Russia, and they're in cahoots with the same kind of actors. I don't believe this bullshit. Sorry, I don't believe this nonsense anymore about
Russia. Feel free to use whatever language you feel is appropriate. Expletives are okay.
Right. Yeah, we really need to change the way we talk about these things and stop fumigating by the failure of others to frame it in ways that we think are more accurate. I think we just need to start talking about it in our terms, and others will have to adapt, I'm afraid.
Yes. That's how I've come to look at it. I went through a period where I was angry and frustrated and believing that having that engine behind my speaking out would possibly get people to think differently about what's going on. But that hasn't seemed to work. So what I can do is keep speaking about what's going on as honestly as I can and not buy into any of these really prefab narratives like West versus East, unipolar versus multipolar. There's no way in hell Russia would blow up its own pipelines. I don't know who is responsible for that. Nobody knows who's responsible for that other than the responsible party. But why is it that most of us can agree that the US is fully capable of carrying out psychotic false flag attacks on its own people and infrastructure, but merely posing that question with regard to Russia is like saying there's no such thing as gravity. I would say it staggers me at this point, but it doesn't, because the people who have invested themselves in and continue to perpetuate vehemently these prefabricated narratives about what's going on, it seems it's what they're meant to do. And I don't know any other way to explain it, but it's certainly not going to stop me, and it shouldn't stop any of us who can look honestly at the deception really that's happening. It shouldn't stop any of us from speaking out against it and putting out as much information as we can to give the lie to this nation state versus nation state nonsense. And it's nonsense because that way of that mode of conflict, as you and I have talked about, by and large, ceased to exist a long time ago. And you'll notice too that in those narratives, there's never or hardly ever any talk of international monetary and finance, for example, and how key that is to everything that is happening, certainly everything that we've been talking about for this hour. So they're really, those narratives and the people invested in them are very anemic and perhaps compromised. I don't know. I'm not going to speculate on people's motives, but it's time that we, as you said, stop buying into this nonsense worldview just because it's what we want to be true. There's so much evidence that points to the fact that it's not what is actually happening, that we really need to wake up and stay awake to what's really happening as best as we can discern it.
Now, absolutely. Now, that does not mean that at certain levels of abstraction, there are actors who actually see things in certain kind of black and white terms. So, for instance, you also mentioned that Sweden has made overtures to Turkey and they've come to an agreement, which, of course, that was completely predictable, that this is all a false tension between Turkey and the two new would-be members of NATO. But what are the big consequences for Sweden is that it has long been a so-called safe haven, being a neutral country and championed itself as protector of human rights. So here in Sweden, we have a lot of unsavory types who are, especially in respect to Iran, who are gung-ho now about waging a revolution in Iran. But there are also many of those who are members of opposition in the context of Turkey, for instance, and especially radical Kurdish elements who have fought a war against a NATO country. And Turkish central government in Ankara has long received support from fellow NATO countries, brother NATO countries, to suppress the various indigenous peoples of southeast Turkey. And the fact that many of them have come to and lived in exile here in Sweden I'm growing more and more suspicious was a neat way of surveilling and keeping an eye on the operations of these very legitimate resistance movements that really were active throughout the Cold War. Now they're going to be, however, the dynamic is changing where there's going to be direct cooperation because Sweden is officially in NATO, that these groups, especially these Kurdish groups, are going to be now targeted by police here. And there's already negotiations about extradition. Now, Denmark has already started forcing people and expelling them and sending them back to their countries of origin, which often means that they will be persecuted for their resistance and their activities against the official state, whether it be in Syria, whether it be in Turkey or Iraq. And that's something to really appreciate that there is a fundamental change going on in the lives of people who will never register in our abstract way of looking at the world. And those are the legitimate resources of human resilience and resistance. These are the Ansar Allah of southeast Turkey, of northern Iraq. And they were the ones who've been persecuting a war of liberation for a long time, very clever people. And they thought they had a safe haven here. They're going to lose that. And that could have very dramatic consequences for the political stability in this country, as well as who knows what's going to happen in other parts of Europe and inside Turkey itself. Because this is it's, again, a coordinated effort to really suppress problematic clusters of sophisticated, organized capacities of resistance. And I think in Donbass and in those parts of eastern Ukraine, they were really hardened people protecting their own people. And I think they have been eliminated. I may be wrong, but I think this war made it very easy for them to be completely pushed aside. And, you know, they would have actually created a difficult resolution, if you will, for the long-term exploitation of the resources of Donbass and these eastern territories. Now that there's a war, and now that they are part of Russia, they are no longer now the intermediaries. And the same applies for places like northern Iraq, for northern Syria, for southeast Turkey, or in indeed Yemen. The Ansarullah are considered non-Yemenis. They're considered Iranian militias. It's like Hezbollah, who are not given the right and recognition of being Lebanese. And this is a method that could translate into greater persecution of those who are really resisting on legitimate claims in Donbass and in eastern Ukraine, if they haven't already been eliminated by this horrible war.